Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files podcast, the podcast that asks questions that nobody's asking simply because there's no good reason to ask them. I'm one of your hosts, John Bruford, joined by your other host, Fintan Costello. Fintan, hello.
Hello, John.
Hi, Fintan, how are you?
I'm doing good. I'm feeling very 4K right now. It's good.
Yeah, you're looking good. What I'm going to do when I output this is I'm going to output it at 520.
Just like a pixelated.
Just to bring you down to my working class level.
Yeah.
That'll teach you.
That's fine. Anyway, I'll learn.
I've got to remind you of who's in the driving seat here. And it's not me, let's be fair. But, Fintan, why are you in 4K today?
I've been working on my podcast camera lighting setup thingy. We've made a big upgrade.
Any particular reason for that?
Nothing I can talk about today.
Oh, Fintan. But it's exciting. When can you talk about it?
Probably in June.
Oh, that's really far away.
Mm.
Well, look, I'm excited for you.
Thank you.
It's okay. Speaking of things I'm excited about.
Oh, go on.
Do you know one of the things that excites me quite a lot?
What would it be? Something to do with testing, maybe?
Well, it's funny you should say that. Did you know, right, that it's an acronym if... And fuck.
Smooth.
Also, I think I've got the word wrong anyway.
Well, you're the words guy. This is what you're meant to do.
No, what's that word for when words make a word?
What's that word for when words make a word?
Like NASA.
Right. This is way... Like, you introduced me to the M-dash, right? I'd never heard of an M-dash before in my life. And then obviously AI made it cool, but, like, I'm... I was dragged up. I'm barely educated.
I can't think what it's... I'm going to have to friggin' Google live. Acronym. Acronym. That was me. I was like, I got my head around an acronym. It's in an acronym. No, it's not. It's definitely not an anachronism.
Great save, Stacey. Thank you. This could have gone on for ages.
Because I'd be Googling, what do you call a word when it's made of words?
I don't know.
Seriously, even Google looks at me funny sometimes.
I was thinking dictionary. My spelling's so bad, the spell check can't get it right. Doesn't even know, like, sorry, this isn't a word. Not even close to any word we could even guess. So that happens to me a lot.
I'm trying to train autocorrect to refer to itself as autocarrot, and it's not going great, but I'm going to keep plugging away, because if it really is learning, it'll get there.
Tell me about testing, John.
Well, no, I was thinking about, because the difference between an acronym, a lot of things are referred to as acronyms, but they're actually initialisms. It's an acronym if it is said as a word. So NASA is an acronym.
Oh.
FBI is an initialism. Because you're saying the letters.
Mm.
So, for example, in the industry, Gaming Laboratories International...
Yeah.
Usually referred to as GLI, that's an initialism. But you know what else, Fintan?
What?
Today's episode is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based lottery and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world.
Wow.
But that's not all. GLI provides suppliers, operators and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. If you'd like more information, Fintan, visit gaminglabs.com.
Okay, noted.
Are you typing it in now?
I'm literally typing it in right now.
Great. I get excited by GLI. It's worth also mentioning we do have another sponsor in the form of World Gaming. And we mention the sponsors every episode because it does actually genuinely make it possible for us to spend time on these things. Because like today, for example, I've got 4 recordings today. It's a lot of recordings. And I've got to be sparkling and witty and urbane for all 4 of them. Unfortunately, I spunked all of that on the first one. So let's see what we, let's see what's left.
Sponsorships are available.
Yes, they are.
We are a podcast empire.
So, Fintan, speaking of podcast empires, we have another sponsor who I believe Excite, and they've announced some big news today. Did you see that news?
They do. There was the sponsor we're referring to, of course, is Optimove.
Optimove.
Who've announced an acquisition of a company that does gamification within the casinos.
Fintan, I'm not sure you've got that right. It's Smartico.
Yeah, I'm sure it's gamification.
I think they do CRM.
Fair enough. Whatever they do, they're clearly really good at it, and they got bought by Optimove, so fair play to everybody there. And I think that's going to be a big win. But obviously the key thing about Optimove is positionless marketing, which is where the overworked marketing manager is expected to do the job of many marketing managers and different people and different channels and different things. And Optimove makes that easy. It's a seamless system that could work across personalized CRM campaigns, dynamically change casino lobbies, and obviously we've got a great guest today to talk about this, bet slips and create engaged, gamified experiences.
Fintan, I've got it. They do gamification.
Sorry.
Hang on. Combined with CRM. So that's actually quite an interesting acquisition. We're not just saying that because they sponsor us.
I'd say worse. but look, go to optimove.com. Tell them we sent you. There is a little bonus if you mention us when you sign up with them. You get a month for free. And it helps make sure that they renew next year and keeps a roof over our heads and fancy lighting setups in Fintan's new podcast studio. So thank you very much.
Roof over my head, fancy lighting systems for Fintan. but Fintan, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're living in a period where the world has gone mad. I think it's fair to say everything is a little bit wild out there in the real world. I mean, I look out the window here in Wales, I can still just see hills and trees and sheep. So that's consistent, but the world has gone absolutely bonkers. And wherever you are on whatever side of any political debates you find yourself on, I hope you're doing okay and you're safe. I'm very excited about today's guest, Fintan.
Me too.
I had to chase her. And this isn't the first time we've asked her either.
No, she said no many times.
Yeah.
Too busy, too important.
And you would know all about that.
Oh, I could sympathise.
But no, I'm genuinely really, really pleased and really excited to introduce our guest, Anastasia Baran, a.k.a. Stacey, COO and Director of Ncube. Stacey, hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Definitely our pleasure.
Yeah, I'm very happy to be here, and I apologize that you had to chase me a bit. It's just because I'm so boring, so I'm sorry. This is not going to go well. It's going to be a real snooze fest.
Okay, well, make sure you lean well back then so we can't hear you very well.
Okay, yeah, I'll do that.
Everybody wins then. Right. Hey, it'd be like a... I've done
obscure
one recording
movie
already.
Reference is about to be dropped.
No. I wasn't going to do an obscure movie reference. I was going to do a thing. What's that thing? Like, my daughter watches these things all the time, and it's like soothing sounds.
Oh.
I wanted to say MRSA, but that's definitely not what I meant.
No.
My daughter's really into MRSA.
I know what you mean. I can't think of the word. It'll come to me.
Yeah, but it would be like that if we're all really far away and we're just sort of mumbling in the background. It'll just be like, you know. I walked up behind my daughter the other day to take her a drink, and there was this lady on her tablet screen, and the lady was going like, I went up behind my daughter and I got your drink. She was like, fucking hey, dude. It's fine. You're safe. So I think all that stuff for relaxation is wildly overrated. She seemed tense to me. Anyway, sorry. So, Stacey, What's the bread and butter? What's the nuts and bolts of what you guys do?
So I like to say that we were doing AI before it was cool. And I think it's largely true. We kind of entered the gaming industry land-based in 2016. And it was with an AI solution that does slot floor optimization. So it's still our main service that we offer. We use a really sophisticated model of the slot floor and a big AI system that we've been creating for about 25 years. And it helps us tell casino operators which machines to buy, which ones to get rid of, and where to put them on the floor. And there's a whole bunch of other problems around that that we solve as well. But that's the core of it.
There's, I mean, tons of questions are firing in my tiny brain. Sure. First things first, is there an optimal size of floor that this works for in terms of number of slots? Because in the UK, they're pretty small generally.
Yeah, so we've worked with casinos as small as about 130 machines, but I think that boundary can be pushed, and I think it would work for around, like, we've done some testing, maybe about 80 machines is a sweet spot. I mean, that's not to say that we can't do it. It's just to say that we haven't had the opportunity to work on a lot of smaller casinos. So anywhere from, let's say, around 100 up to, you know, we've worked with 4,000 machines on a slot floor. So it's funny that you mentioned size as well, because right sizing casinos has been a big deal over the last couple of years for us. So we've done a lot of projects where it's really about finding the right number of machines for a property. And more often than not, actually, I can say probably about 100% of the situations we're working in, casinos just have too many machines on the floor. So we can actually find additional opportunity for revenue by strategically removing certain machines on the floor.
That's interesting, because, I mean, like if you look at Vegas very specifically, like if you go back 30 years, yeah, probably 30 years, maybe even a little bit less, you've got 70% of revenue is slot floor. And now, obviously, that's a complete turnaround, but it's still a massive amount of revenue. It's still like 30%+ of revenue. Obviously, most casinos in Vegas, both locals and Fremont Street, obviously the Strip, we're talking big numbers of machines. But what I've noticed in recent years is, certainly a couple of places, I mean, when, I think it's the Sahara now, but when SLS opened as SLS, they went for a boutique floor. When Downtown Grand opened, they've gone for a boutique-style floor. So it's a much smaller number of slots, and it's a much less intimidating space. Yeah, you know, it's not a massive flung-open area. And yet, you go to Macau, and historically, all of the US-owned casinos in Macau certainly used to, they just piled numbers in there. And of course, it was a market where slots weren't relevant. Nobody gave two shits. And that's not the local currency. I mean, nobody gave a shit about the slots. And it was, you know, it was a learning experience. The assumption was that you could take the American gaming model and just stick it in a casino in China and people will come and visit. But they very rapidly found that that wasn't the case. So anyway, I'm rambling a little bit here. So even in reasonable sized resorts in Vegas, there is still a lean sometimes towards a more boutique operation rather than 3,000-4,000 machines. But something that you just said in there just made me go, what? Which machines to buy? Like, are you saying that you can look at a setup, you can look at the machines they've got in there, you'll know their replacement cycle, and you can look at what they've got, and you can go, this will be a complement to it? You know, how? What data are you using to make that? And I'm going to stop me if this is a cheeky word to use, but what data are you using to make that assumption?
Ooh, assumption. That is cheeky. I mean, casinos are amazing for data. It's part of what really attracted me to the casino industry to begin with. I'm a scientist from way back and was looking for an industry that, you know, I could apply my skills to because I've worked with data my whole career. Casino data is second to none, and a casino operator is, you know, they're so shy about their data sometimes. You know, they think it's bad, but absolutely every transaction on the floor is being recorded. And we look at extremely fine-grained session-level slot data. So, I mean, we can go down to the individual handle pull. Usually we go about, you know, 5-10 minutes, maybe half an hour for a large casino in granularity in the sessions, and we take about 5 years worth of data. So our model, the slot floor, models the interactions that are happening on the floor. It models all the relationships between machines and machines, machines and players, and also players and other players. So it's really pulling apart the relationship, the ecosystem, essentially, that is the slot floor, and then figuring out what the dynamics are on that slot floor. And then once it learns that, it turns it around and it says, okay, well, how do I build a better slot floor? So when we're making a recommendation to buy a particular machine, what we're doing is we're segmenting the players on the floor and we're also segmenting the machines on the floor based on how the players are responding to them. So it's kind of like a Netflix style algorithm where, you know, they know what movie you want to see before you know. And similarly with slot machines, there's going to be certain machines that are overrepresented or underrepresented on the floor, given the player population. So when we say, oh, you need to buy more of these machines, it's because our model has determined, you know, there are players on your floor that are showing up and all these machines are occupied. You have capacity for these machines. They're high performers. Your players are going to enjoy them. And similarly, even if there's a machine that's a hit and, you know, it's really popular, if it's overrepresented on the floor, it could be distracting play from other regions of the floor. And, you know, maybe some of those players will go to another region and spend more money. It could be just taking up valuable real estate. So there's a lot of balance happening there. And our system is pulling all those relationships apart and saying this is what your optimal floor is.
But the prediction aspect of that, saying these are the games you should buy, it's not necessarily saying here's a game you don't have and here's what you could buy because it will do this when it's in your floor. We're talking about buying a cabinet that you might already have because you can expand on that existing appeal.
Mostly. So I'll add to that it's about buying a cabinet that you already have, but our system pulls apart the properties of the machine that the players are responding to. So for example, there might be a cabinet that's really hot and, you know, there's capacity to purchase more of them and make more money. What our system does though, is it says the players like this machine because of its theme. They like it because it has this volatility. They like it because of this number of reels. It's in this type of cabinet. You know, it takes apart all the things that are important to the players. And that doesn't mean every property of the machine. It's actually determining what it is about that cabinet that the players like. And because, you know, it's kind of a philosophy of ours that we want to use the data that the casino has. We don't take other sources of data. We don't make assumptions, to come back to that word. We don't make assumptions about machines that are similar that a casino doesn't have. We take the casino's own data and their own player database to make the casino environment just more appealing to the players that they have. It's not a marketing tool, right? It's about how do we give them a great experience, the people that are already there. So in terms of buying new cabinets, yes, we might say, buy 4 more of this cabinet that you already have. Well, what if the operator goes to the manufacturer and they don't have that anymore? They don't make it anymore. Well, the operator can then, you know, say, well, it's actually these properties of the cabinet, these properties of the game that my players are responding to. What do you have that fits in that category? So how do we find something that my players like based on what they're responding to in these cabinets?
Is what you do about, and I know obviously you've talked a bit about the fundamentals of what you do, but I just want to make sure I understand one thing, because there's something about casinos and the flow of people that I find really interesting. Is what you do, is it solely about optimizing those machine interactions and the customer experience in those interactions on the slot floor? Or is there an aspect of the flow and movement of people in there as well?
Well, I mean, I think both is the answer to your question. I mean, at the end of the day, it's about optimizing. It's about optimizing floors so the casino makes more money. I mean, that's the goal, right?
There's always going to be hot and cold spots on a floor, isn't there? Because of the way that rooms are set up. You know, nobody's going to want to sit next to the lavs.
Absolutely. And there might be many machines on the floor that players don't even touch. But they're not harmful if they're not, you know, taking away money from high lease costs. They're not harmful if they're just taking up space. They become harmful if they distract play from other more profitable regions of the floor. Sorry, I got a bit distracted on this one. The point was the flow of the players. It is certainly taking into account the flow of the players. So we model the players that are at machines, and we also model the players that are not at machines. So we have an idea at any point how many players are on the floor. And this is not, like, we're not recording their movements. We're not using camera data. It's nothing like that. It's about creating a math model that's actually taking into account the flow of players that are not at machines.
So is that why, because you released a study about removing machines can increase hold. Is that why then? Because it's less distracting? Or because obviously, you know, more is better would be kind of the rule of thumb, like more machines. But by removing machines, you can make more money. What was the catalyst of that? Or what was the change in behavior that triggered that?
So during casino shutdowns, during COVID, we had some projects where we were helping casinos determine which machines they should keep on. So, you know, a lot of the regulations were you have to shut off every other machine, or, you know, you have to shut off certain banks, and there had to be certain, like, distancing rules associated with that. So we were working on some projects where it was, okay, which machines should we keep on, and how do we arrange the floor to optimize for safety, but also to maximize revenue in this situation. And we were discovering that even though we were shutting off a lot of the machines, there wasn't a huge impact to revenue. And, you know, this comes with the caveat of obviously there's going to be fluctuations in the number of players based on, you know, regulations or how many you could have in the casino. But we weren't detecting a major change in revenue associated with shutting off the machines. And throughout these projects, the operators were asking us, you know, what's going on here? And through the analysis and taking it through when they could turn machines back on, the discussion became, well, maybe we don't turn everything back on. Maybe some of these machines actually, you know, they're gone permanently because we're not, you know, we're paying lease costs for them and we're not seeing a true impact on the floor based on having all these machines. So that was the origin story of, you know, getting us thinking about, well, what does the optimal floor size actually look like?
And like that carried through post COVID, because obviously you could argue maybe with COVID restrictions, it's just people are just excited to be out of the house and just, you know, money to spend and just want to go have some fun. It's carried on well past COVID.
Yeah, it has. You know, even last year we were working on slot floor reduction projects and really, you know, figuring out which machines should go. And in every case, as I mentioned, we saw either a stable revenue or an increase.
And is it, like, obviously there's the famous marmalade experiment where in economics where, like, if you got a supermarket and you've got, like, 25 variations of marmalade versus, I don't know, 3 or whatever it is, you'll sell more with 3 than 25 because people are overwhelmed by choice and da-da-da. Is it that kind of psychology taking place or is it something more? Kind of more dependent on the casino and time and place and movement and stuff like that?
That's an interesting question. I haven't really looked at it from the marmalade experiment point of view. One thing I can say, and that I see pretty frequently, is that there are often really popular slot machines that our system suggests to get rid of half of them, for example. And this is a difficult discussion to have with operators. You know, when we come with recommendations and say, well, actually, you know, your most popular machine, get rid of most of them. And the reason for that is they're distracting players from other machines that are simply more profitable. So there are groups of players that will play these super popular machines, but they also might go in the high limit area. They also might spend more time in another region of the floor. So we kind of tag them as distractor machines. And ultimately, despite their popularity, they're a detriment to the floor. And this is something that, you know, most of, like, you can't really pull that out. Like, it's a, without having the math to back it up, that's a really difficult decision to make. So there are...
Is there a, sorry to jump across, is there a scarcity thing as well? So, like, if the most popular machines are full, there's a psychological thing of, well, I've waited to get onto this machine. So, like, I live in Amsterdam, so I don't know, there's a, I was in the city center the other day, and there was this one place selling chips or fries that's, like, TikTok famous. And, like, the queue of people to get fries from this one place was insane. Because, and then the queue created the bigger queue, right? So demand created demand and these kind of things. Is there a similar psychological thing there as well? Or is it just, you know, hey, they've got an hour, let's just move them to more profitable product lines, and just, it's just more, is it more, is it, I suppose, is it a psychological thing or is it an efficiency thing?
That's a great question. I mean, I don't have the answer to that. I'm not sure... I mean, we look at the math, right? And I'm not sure we need the psychological answer to it because we have the impact, right? We have the evidence.
We've got the data.
Yeah, and you know that's fine for me. And if it results in more money, that's great. I find it very interesting from a psychological point of view. I've certainly been at a casino where you see, you know, people crowding around really popular machines. So yeah, absolutely, that could be the case. I'm at an age where I don't wait in line for anything, so I can't like personally empathize with that.
Yeah.
But it makes sense.
So, okay, if we go to the, it's probably not psychology, but it was more communication. You ran a fantastic experiment around players detecting hold. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. So myself and my business partner, I'm a former academic and he's actually still a research active prof at the University of Manitoba in astrophysics. And we are, as much as we can be, you know, try to follow all the University of Nevada, Las Vegas journals. You know, we're really into the academic side of what's going on with gaming as well. It's actually, which like, our first foray into gaming was on the academic side. And the gambling and risk-taking conference was coming up about 3 years ago. And like any academic, we put an abstract in without having done any of the work for the conference because you hope that that's going to get you to actually doing the work. So we were like, you know what, I think we can run an experiment on how players detect hold. So we put the abstract in and, you know, naturally about a month and a half before the conference, we're like, we really need to start doing some work on this because it's really coming up fast. And we designed some experiments. And you know what, I'll say as well that it was also related back to the COVID stuff where we were running simulations of players in the casino and how they moved. And what we did here is we added a component of communication between the players. So we simulated what was going on with the games. So what does the payout table actually look like based on the session data? So what's the player actually experiencing in terms of hold? And how are they communicating with each other? And, you know, the old controversial topic is simply, can an individual player detect a change in hold on a machine? And we were still, you know, supporting the work in saying that an individual player can certainly not detect reasonable changes in hold on machines because the number of games you'd have to play are so huge. However, when you introduce communication between the players, and that doesn't necessarily, like we call it a social network, but that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, a social network and how we're all used to it now. It also means buses of seniors going to casino and they all just talk.
People chatting and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Friends at the bar after. as soon as you introduce levels of communication between these players, suddenly those signals get amplified. And if there's been a hold change, you get all this new information about all these different games that have been played, and they have more information. So once that communication is introduced, yes, the players start being able to detect changes of hold. Similarly, misinformation also travels very quickly along a network. So it's really important for casinos to control what players might think of their brand, especially if they change the hold and that communication starts to propagate. It's very difficult to come back, maybe even impossible to come back from that brand damage. So we're really, there's a lot of interesting relationships that happen.
And is the brand damage on a game level or a casino level?
On a casino level. So the experiment itself was done between two locals casinos, where one would change their hold and one would not.
Yeah, okay. Wow. That's really interesting. Because from a brand perspective, like, could be detrimental, right?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Could be more than detrimental. It could be killer.
It's, yeah. Okay, so a couple more follow-on questions for that. So, like you said, hey, we've got the data, and this is what the data says, right? So the data beats opinion kind of scenario. You've been in business for a long time, you've bootstrapped, you've done some really, really cool stuff over time. What was particularly, obviously you've got a big body of work behind you now, so I'm sure these conversations are much easier, but in the early days, when you're sat there with, you know, a general manager, 25, 30 years of experience, has the gut feel, has worked on the casino floor, feels like, no, this is wrong, or this is not how it's done, how did you overcome that?
So, Fenton, I'd like to jump in before Stacey answers that question.
Go for it, John.
And I'd like to say two things. One, you should know better than to raise marmalade in this podcast.
It was actually jam, not marmalade. I panicked. It's trying to be too clever.
You know Big Marmalade is listening.
We've had a whole thing. Stacey, we've had a whole thing about marmalade. Sorry, John. Sorry for triggering. It's very passionate about marmalade. It's as Paddington Bear comes out.
I don't even eat marmalade.
Really?
Yeah.
The way you go on about it.
I just did a feature on marmalade like 23 years ago, and it stayed with me. It stayed in my heart. It was a great feature, though. Anyway, what you're talking about to me is like, and stop me if this is a really bad analogy, because I have made bad analogies before and I will make them again. This is people talk about homeopathic medicine, and there's a great Mitchell and Webb sketch about homeopathic hospital. Man's been hit by a car. Okay, we're gonna need a paint sample from the car that hit him. We're gonna have to dilute it 1,000 times and then rub it on his elbow. That kind of thing. And it's fantastic. But of course the basis of homeopathy is what kind of became medicine. You know, herbal remedies for things that were being used centuries and centuries ago. And some of that became the basis for modern medicine, and that's how things were discovered by people doing shit.
So you're saying homeopathy came before medicine?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that herbal remedies.
Okay, that's very different. Okay, fine.
Became medicine and all that jazz. And that's kind of what this is, because that guy with 20, 30 years of experience, his experience is real.
Yeah.
And he might not be able to quantify it or even explain it. But the data does that and refines it and takes the gut feel out of it, doesn't it? But I mean, the way that it's been done in the past, it's not incorrect. This is just way more efficient, right? So the gut is herbal remedies. and this is science.
I think my question, which maybe we need to reframe the question then, is
maybe I'm an idiot.
There's going to be things in the data which the GM is just going to react against and say, this is, like, for example, removing machines. like I'm just picking out something we've done. But so it's more that kind of, oh my god, we can't do this. Or you guys don't know how a casino works.
What Stacey was saying earlier about, you know, if you put this machine's more profitable. What the floor manager is going to say is, yeah, but I've got no guarantee that that person that wants to play that machine is going to walk over and play that machine.
We should probably let Stacey answer. She tells all
I'm that. Just making sure that we're covering everything for Stacey to answer. Stacey.
You guys got it. It's okay. Continue.
We'll come to an answer one.
It must be like two like really dumb first year grads just bumbling around your office. It's just like, oh my god, is it not lunchtime yet?
How did they let them out of high school?
These grads are getting dumber. Convinced of it.
I don't know. I mean, to answer your question, in the early days it was very difficult. Like, I'm not going to pretend that we had an easy time by any means. And at the time as well, nobody wanted to talk about AI. It's all anybody wants to talk about now, which, you know, upsets me in a different way. But like at the time, nobody wanted to talk about AI. They didn't, you know, believe it could do what it could do. Like, we're talking 2016, things happen really quickly. So it was a tough sell. In the casino industry, land-based in particular, it's really about, it's about your staying power. It's about building those relationships. It's about building trust. So as you were saying, you know, we had to get like a large body of work behind us to build that trust, had to form those relationships. And certainly if there is a skeptic that we're working with in a particular situation, we don't have to ignore them. We don't have to fight them. If they feel particularly passionate about something that they want to keep, we just put it in the model. They can keep it, right? And we'll work around whatever those constraints happen to be. So we want to make it as easy as possible. We're not looking for a fight. Well, I'm happy to have a beer with somebody and debate them over it, but when it comes to work product and, you know, running the casino, it's not in our best interest to have fights. It's really about just doing what works best for the casino.
Okay, so the follow-on question to that then, and you kind of touched on it in terms of everybody's talking about AI now. So again, if we use that example of the general manager, 25, 30 years of experience, isn't an AI expert, and now he's probably been bombarded, or she's been bombarded with 500 AI experts, with, you know, ChatGPT and whatever tools and bullshit and smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
How would they identify the real ones from the fakers? And this industry is great at fakers.
Yeah. There are not 500 AI experts. Like, I don't think there are 500 AI experts in our industry.
No, there isn't. Self-proclaimed on LinkedIn, maybe, but not in reality.
I don't want to paint online with the same brush as well, because online has been doing stuff like this before we were doing it. Like, I don't want to make any claims about online. But in terms of land-based, I don't think there are 500 AI experts. And thankfully, we have that track record, right? Like, we have credentials, we have the technology, and we can rely on that when we are, you know, setting ourselves apart. But certainly, we're competing for budget with people that are, you know, coming up with wrappers around ChatGPT and are just using AI as marketing buzz. I don't know, like, I know my own feelings about seeing all these different AI products out there and my frustration in mind. Like, I'm tired of it, honestly. Like, I don't need to see it. I don't, like, Apple AI or Apple Intelligence or whatever it is, I just, you know, I shut it off. Like, any AI product I have in my own technology stream, for the most part, I don't really use, to be honest. Like, I'll use ChatGPT or whatever to proofread my emails or, you know, do some... I was just searching for a wine fridge, but other than that, it's not part of my workflow.
And is that because it's a bit like the chef, like, coming home and making some pot noodles because they've been cooking all day, or is it just you don't think the technology's there yet?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the technology, it's probably there for certain tasks, and like I said, I do use it for certain tasks. It's not for me, and there's nothing for me yet. That really, like, in terms of creating tech and, like, the type of AI we do is very different than large language models and things like that. It's very math-based. It's about making predictions. It's not about next word predictors or anything like that. But there's just, other than chat, there hasn't really been a tool that I really feel like I need in my workflow yet. If that changes, great. If not, I'm perfectly happy to continue using a desktop computer like a proper elder millennial. And, you know, we'll see what happens.
And then you talked about online, because obviously, you know, I think online is obviously different, but has a lot of the same issues as land-based, where, you know, they will shove 3,000 game variations in front of the player and expect the player to kind of fend for themselves and figure it out. Is there applications in your modeling for online casinos?
Yeah, we often say that we should have started an online first, because you don't, from a mathematical perspective, it's a little bit of an easier problem because you don't have the real estate constraints that you have on a land-based floor. So there's a lot of spatial considerations that we have to take into account in land-based, you know, including restrictions on number of machines and things like that. In online, there's a lot more freedom in terms of what games you're putting in front of people. You don't have the same constraints. So I think it's highly applicable. I think a lot of people are doing it. I'm not sure it's a market that is open for new players necessarily. I think we would do a great job of it, but it's definitely a highly applicable problem. And the data is fantastic as well. Every player is carded, and you know, it's just another fantastic data source.
Could I ask about your first project? Like, as N-Cube, you must have, you probably had a bit of time where you were like, oh shit, are we ever going to sign anybody up? And you get your foot in that first door, right? What did you learn on that first project, and what came out of it? I mean, was it like hugely successful? Did you bankrupt somebody? You know, I'm going to assume not.
No. First project was a bit of a, I mean, I don't want to say fail. We learned a lot. I think the casino learned a lot. 10 years ago, the data we needed wasn't necessarily readily available. And honestly, we encounter this to this day, where it takes a long time to communicate exactly what data needs to be extracted in order for us to do our model. So I think we had a wake-up call as to how we need to communicate with operators about what we need. And at the same time, like, they didn't necessarily know what they were collecting and how to give us the information we required. So first project was kind of like, oh, let's see your data. Let's try to apply the model to it. But ultimately it was like, well, this isn't, like, we don't have the granularity. There's gaps in the data. It's too aggregate. Like, it was just, it didn't work out from that perspective, right? We couldn't mesh on just kind of first steps. That was very early on. That was like day one.
No, but that's super interesting, because, yeah, I've been saying for years, like, data in this industry, in the land-based side, I mean, it's just coming in from all sides, huge amounts of data. And unless you're a massive organization, and there are whole businesses that have sprung up to sort of pass and kind of represent that data in an easily digestible format for operators. You know, there are whole companies around just doing that. But it's really interesting that, you know, I've got this image in my head of like an operator just turning up with a big bucket of data. You know, brought the data.
Bin bag.
Yeah, basically. With a hole in the bottom. But it's true stuff. Because, you know, you need a certain bunch of things in a certain way, and it's a re-education just to be able to get to the point at which you can help somebody.
So how much of every project is just data cleaning at the beginning and just getting the data in a usable format?
Huge component. Like, just if everything goes as planned, it should really take us like less than a week to get everything set up. But it's like, it can take a long time. Like, if... like, we've had as many as, I would say, 8 or 9 iterations on some data projects. So ultimately, like, once we get into the groove, as long as we keep getting the data in the same format, it's a really quick turnaround from getting data to results. So we'll do like a monthly update. It's really quick. But that initial data pipelining, that's a big hurdle. And that's, you know, even to this day, it's still a struggle. And, you know, that's fine. We're happy to work with people on it. But I think there's a lot of general discussion on AI readiness now. And data is a huge, like, that's the main component of it. Without the data, there is no AI mm-hmm. readiness. So, you know, I think maybe, you know, that's step one. People, like, casino operators need to understand where they're at with understanding their own data and how to properly use it. And I don't want to disparage anyone. I just think everybody's at kind of a different level. And if you want to use AI, it's the faster to understand that.
But it's surprising given that, you know, the land-based casino industry has embraced loyalty cards and loyalty points and is meant to be, like, is held up as this gold standard of tracking the customer behavior and insights and being able to, you know, that kind of reactivation and retention of players, bringing them back to the casino. Is that just like a couple of good case studies is painting a broad brush for everybody, or is it just not applied to the floor? It's just not the data you need. It's just different. They're good at different data.
It's not the data that we need, but I think that, you know, I could speak to that a bit generally. I think that similarly, there are companies that will go into data-ready casinos that are very sophisticated and that can do these complex analyses. But there's also a ton of consultants that do an awesome job of taking spreadsheets and, you know, data sources that are all over the place and breaking it down and creating actionable insights from that. But that's a lot of work to sit down and actually put together those data sources. So it's, you know, it's all different levels, and, you know, people do what they can with the data that's available.
Interesting. Great questions, Fenton, because I'm usually the details guy.
We know. Yes, you are. You're my details guy.
Oh, terrible. 4 years of this, Fenton.
Oh, what's your favorite casino?
Ooh, yeah, that's a good question.
Ooh. That's so difficult.
Yeah, you're gonna piss off somebody.
Do you piss off a customer?
to go to, like, my favorite casino to be in.
What's your favorite? Just you walked in and go, yeah, I like that. This one's my favorite.
Oh man, that's such a hard question. I mean, in Las Vegas, I often stay at Sahara. I mean, I like, or when it was SLS, I stayed there as well. I like it there because I liked it because it was like a little bit off strip, but now it's all built up around there anyway, so kind of a different situation.
No, when it was SLS, they had that lovely bar with a deck out the front. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
That was so nice.
I know. Yeah, it's a good spot.
I was in there one night, right, and I was having a few beers back when I still drank. I was having a few beers and reading a book. I was on my own. And this guy walks in. Three guys walk in. One of them's about my height, and his two friends are about a foot taller than him. So his two friends are about 6'5", 6'6". And this little fella, much smaller than me, I mean, he's a tiny little skinny fella. He looks at me and he just suddenly shouts, "Baldy!" And I'm like, I looked at him and I looked at his two friends and I said, "Do you seriously fucking think I didn't realize I was bald when I left my fucking hotel room today?" Luckily, he had the good grace to look embarrassed.
Yeah, that's... I mean, in case you didn't know, I guess, he was just...
He was right. I mean, you know, in terms of data analysis, he was spot on.
Scientific observation.
But I think his presentation was lacking.
Agreed. But I feel, okay, so it just occurred to me. I will say my favorite casino of all time, it no longer exists, was the Imperial Palace in Las Vegas.
No way.
Yeah, I love that place. I think about it often still. The link just
made it special.
You know, I do talk about this often, even though I shouldn't. My family has been taking me to Las Vegas since I was 13 years old. And that was like my grandmother's place that she would go to because it's the only place that she would know how to get around. They used to have, like, you know, the old school, like, champagne buffets where it was, like, champagne on tap. Like, it was just, like,
let's go.
It was proper old school Vegas, and it just had a special place in my heart.
But even when IP was sort of gutted and refurbed to what it is now, it was a really weird bridge between old style Vegas and new Vegas. You know, you would still have rooms with mirrored ceilings. In fact, I stayed in a room that had a mirror over the hot tub. I wish I were joking. I'm like looking at it thinking there's only so much I need to see. But also they had one of the truly great cafe restaurants on the strip. One of the best steak and eggs places I've ever been to. And I was gutted when it was refurbed and that was one of the things that went. But I spent my honeymoon there.
Oh, nice. Huh. I think that's the place that had the champagne tap.
Okay. It was right in the middle.
Yeah.
It was just above the gaming floor, I think, if I remember right.
Yeah, exactly.
But no, it was a tremendous property. It was also a huge property and right in the middle of the strip.
Yeah.
It's a really good location. It's where the Link is now and the Eye and all that jazz, Fintan. Probably doesn't mean anything to you because you hit up Monaco.
I'm an online guy. I'm sorry.
But do you ever when you walk into a casino now, you're presumably doing it with your business brain firing as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you say like you don't use AI in your life, but you're still going to look around at a floor and you're going to think, do you know what they could?
It says like the Terminator just scanning everything.
That's
just like,
it.
She, unoptimized and I could get me the manager. We're going to fix some stuff while I'm here.
Turns around to the member of staff and says, "Fuck you, asshole."
Give me your jacket.
give me your clothes. I hope it's Bill Paxton that you said that to, by the way. Anyway, I'm getting distracted by Bill Paxton, but I mean, Bill was great. One of the things that I loved, I was in SLS, right, and it was shortly after it opened, and I went to, there was a pizza place, and it was right on, there was the boutique gaming floor, and there's a pizza place in the corner. And I'm like, who positioned this? And I saw the marketing director later, and I'm like, why is it there? Why is it in that spot? He said, did you not see what was next to it? I'm like, what's next to it? He said, it's the exit to the nightclub. I'm like, oh, that's genius. Because they had this oven that operated at such a high heat that you could have a pizza done in 90 seconds. And it was a good pizza as well. It was a really good pizza. So you go and you say, I have that. It was basically, it was a Subway for pizza, but it was really good pizza. And you get it, and in 90 seconds, you're out the door. And it's right next to the nightclub. Kicking out time. Probably 4 a.m. They're probably heaving. That's efficiency.
One last question, if it's okay. Obviously, we're in the middle of an AI boom. OpenAI, Anthropic are due to do IPOs this year. And there's $1 trillion valuations being thrown around like it's nothing. Ncube IPO this year. Cash in. What do we say?
We could talk offline about that. I mean, I can't really make any announcements yet, but we're up there with those guys too, for sure.
I have one last question as well. AI is it's been bandied about a lot. I think it might be Spielberg's worst film. Do you have a favorite Spielberg film?
Oh. No, I don't.
Which one's Spielberg?
Yeah, right. Like,
I'm not a movie person either. I get it.
Did he do the first Jurassic Park?
He did, yeah.
Yeah, Jurassic Park.
Okay.
What? All right. I'm sorry to have disappointed you.
No, you didn't.
Don't gatekeep, John. Don't gatekeep. Stacey like Jurassic Park. She like Jurassic Park.
I remember sitting in the cinema watching the first Jurassic Park, and you're obviously both clearly younger than me, but I remember sitting in the cinema watching the first Jurassic Park in like 1991, I think, 1990, 91. And me and my peers were all like, you know, 17, 18 years old. And there were loads of kids in the cinema. Obviously, it was a PG. but all the kids in the cinema were really blasé about it. We're sitting there going, how did they train these dinosaurs? And all the kids are like, man, it's a fucking dinosaur. And we're all like, that was an amazing experience. Anyway, I digress. God bless Bill Paxton. We miss you, Bill. I'm going to hit stop now. Thank you very much, Stacey, for joining us. It was very, very much appreciated. 100% what I was hoping for. Thank you.
Thanks for putting up with us.
Yes, that too.
Thanks so much for having me. You guys are a joy. I appreciate it.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just at Gambling Files. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.